True crime horror story contains extreme violence and adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Host JD Horror, and this is True Crime Horror Story, Season 2, Episode 2, Flesh for Satan, Part 2. Part 1, Say You Love Satan. It was the night of June 19th, 1984, and Teenage Burnouts, Jimmy Troiano, Albert Canones, Gary Lowers, and the Acid King, Ricky Casso, ventured out into Aztekia Woods to take cheap LSD and party. As the group consumed drugs and the night went on, it soon became apparent to Gary that the pretense of getting fucked up in the woods was just a ploy for something darker. Though Gary had repaid a drug debt to Ricky and was said to be forgiven, an argument ensued, and Ricky Casso pulled out a 4-inch folding knife. He began stabbing Gary Lowers repeatedly in the back, arms, and chest as Ricky screamed, "Say you love Satan." As Gary begged for his life, at first he refused to pledge his allegiance to the Dark Lord. Instead, through his tears and squeals of agony, Lowers kept repeating that he loved his mother. Eventually, as it bladed in his flesh over and over and the life leaked out of his body, Gary gave in to the Acid King's commands and pledged his allegiance to Satan. Though he ultimately had given in to his attacker's diabolic demands, he was granted no reprieve as Ricky Casso continued to stab away at the boy's body, thrusting the knife into his flesh over 30 times in total before eventually removing the teenager's eyes, all while repeating the phrase,
"Say you love Satan."
Northport, Long Island. A quiet community wrought by reports a teenager was dragged through these woods toward a late-night ritual of death. An eyewitness said the victim, Gary Lowers, was forced to pray to Satan as he was repeatedly stabbed to death.
There are over 12 million teenagers and younger children who are now involved in the occult in one way or another.
Two young men were arrested. James Troiano was found innocent last month, but his alleged accomplice never made it to trial. Ricky Casso committed suicide in jail the day after his arrest.
How in the world does a young man in the prime of his teen years go from being an A student, a football player? How does that young man become a satanic murderer?
Casso was into Satanism and rock music associated with devil worship.
How does that young man go from that A student football player to a satanic killer? And more importantly, could it be happening right now to the kid next door?
To get a deeper insight on the background and crimes of Ricky Casso, I reached out to author and filmmaker Jesse Polak. Jesse has done extensive research on the Casso case for his book, The Acid King, as well as the upcoming documentary of the same name. You'll hear from Jesse throughout the episode, and also stay tuned after the normal episode for my interview with Jesse about the upcoming film and his writing career. The Boy Who Would Be King. Richard Allen Casso Jr., aka Ricky, was born on March 29, 1967. His father, Dick Casso, was a high school football coach and social studies teacher at Cold Spring Harbor High School. His mother, Lynn, stayed at home, though sometimes she would work at the school as well. Ricky was what you would call a towhead, with blonde hair and blue eyes, though like many, his hair darkened as he matured, similar to his personality. At first, Ricky was a good student and a hell of an athlete, but then in middle school, he found music, and more importantly, drugs, and his overbearing father started to lose his grip on the boy.
By all accounts, the first few years of his life were pretty normal. He was a happy kid, didn't show any signs of mental illness or any other issues, really enjoyed sports. His father gave an interview to a newspaper after the murder where he discussed how Ricky would get up at 6 a.m. to play, you know, an hour's worth of football with his friends on the block before going to school. So very much all-American kid, seemingly all-American family for the first probably 9 or 10 years. And then as Ricky approached adolescence, things really started to change. He grew disinterested with sports, and his father, who was an award-winning football coach in addition to being a social studies teacher, just wasn't having it. He was very disappointed that his son no longer wanted to pursue sports, and it grew to the point where I had friends of Ricky telling me when I was working on the book that at one point Ricky was late to a football practice in junior high, and his father responded by beating him with a broomstick, and Ricky came to school the next day showing his friends the bruises. What started out as a very normal family life quickly grew into, you know, unfortunately, a very familiar suburban horror. He faced a lot of verbal and mental abuse from his father, and by all accounts, his mother, Lynn, was too afraid to intervene because she was afraid of facing the wrath of Dick Casso as well.
The oldest of the Casso siblings, Ricky, had three younger sisters. Though his father looked down on the boy, on the contrary, the Casso sisters lacked Ricky's rebellious nature and growing disdain for authority. They were the athletic, respectful kids that Dick Casso had always wanted, not the apathetic boy who was refusing to cut his hair.
Ricky had three younger sisters, all of which were average kids. They did not have the rebellion issues that Ricky started to display when he entered adolescence, and two of them became star athletes by all accounts at the school. So as Ricky threw away his father's ambitions for him, his two younger sisters picked them up, and Dick Casso focused his attention on them. And as they achieved more and more academically and athletically, Ricky just became more and more disposable to Dick, and it eventually ended up where Ricky decided he was going to quit football altogether when he was in junior high, and Dick responded by literally throwing him out of the house.
After being kicked out of the family home, Ricky dropped out of school in the 8th grade. With a lack of options, he started selling drugs to make ends meet on the street. Abandoned by his family, he turned to his friends for places to stay, but more often than not, he was left out in the cold and alone.
By the time he was, accounts differ. Some of his friends say it was 13, other friends say it was 14. But around that 6th, 7th grade area, you know, leading into freshman year of high school, he was thrown out of the house and resorting to couch crashing with friends. He would sleep in unlocked cars that were left on the main drag in Northport. And at one point, he was even sleeping on the floor of a bathroom in the parking lot of a local beach. So not to excuse what he later did, I mean, what he did was completely unexcusable, but it's hard to not see the trajectory there that something bad was eventually going to happen. He was literally abandoned by his family. He was left to fend for himself, and part of fending for himself became selling drugs to his classmates and even people older than him.
Since he felt like no one gave a shit about him, Ricky started not giving a shit about anything at all. He was always getting into trouble, living on the streets in the quest for the endless high. By his teens, he was 40 pounds underweight, suicidal, and had no short-term memory after developing the habit of taking over 10 hits of acid a night.
By the time he was 16 years old, he was one of the chief suppliers of hallucinogens in that area of Suffolk County. I mean, this kid was going as far as to hopping on a train and going in and picking up his supply from the South Bronx. Now, to younger listeners, that may not sound like any big deal, but in the early 1980s, the South Bronx was in such a state of disrepair and urban turmoil that Ronald Reagan, when he visited it as president, compared it to Europe in the aftermath of bombings in World War II. Like, people called it literally a war zone. So for this kid at 15 and 16 years old to have really no issue with jumping on a train and going into this section of the Bronx to buy drugs to sell back home in Northport really speaks to how he had to adapt to his situations. And it's honestly really sad. I honestly think that what eventually happened might not have happened if society and his family and the institutions in Northport hadn't failed this kid as bad as they did. but it was a different time.
Like many of the killers we talked about, Ricky's traumatic childhood was a major contributing factor in his later mental state. Coupled with head injury like we see in so many others, although Ricky's form of head injury would be due to excessive drug use and not a fall down a flight of stairs or a baseball bat.
The correlations between childhood trauma and abuse and adulthood violence is so well documented, it's not even funny. Even going all the way back to the 70s with the work that John Douglas was doing in the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, all the way now to modern social work. In fact, one of Ricky's peers in Northport, who I interviewed for the book and later for the documentary, became a professor of social work and a prominent social worker out on Long Island today. And he really opened my eyes to a lot of the research that's been going on, that these children, especially children in lower economic brackets, which Ricky really wasn't so much a part of. His family wasn't well off, but they had a decent house in Northport, and his father made enough money as a teacher where Lynn was able to be a stay-at-home mom for most of the year. Sometimes she would pick up extra work around the holiday season working in the office at the high school, but he was right there in the middle. I would say lower middle class. But the correlation there with the childhood trauma and abuse, and again, like I mentioned, with especially with lower economic families, is it can literally cause brain damage. When you abuse a child that young, whether it be emotionally or physically, the brain, the frontal cortex of the brain, does not grow the way that a normal brain is supposed to. And it leads to poor impulse control, depression, anxiety, all of the classic hallmarks that, you know, we see in these people that later become serial killers. Now, that's not to say that everyone with a bad childhood or mental illness, depression, or anxiety is going to become a serial killer, but you look at all of these famous serial killers, your Gacy's, your Ted Bundy's, your Jeffrey Dahmer's, they all had traumatic childhoods, usually as the result of an overbearing parent. So I definitely think that this is a classic case of this kid was not getting what he needed at home and he lashed out due to a series of issues that eventually became beyond his control.
As his apathy and depression grew in his teens, Ricky was seldom sober, usually blasted out of his mind on weed, hash, LSD, PCP, or mescaline. More often than not, a combination of the drugs.
Ricky's drug use, by all accounts, was a result of his situation and his desperation. Him selling was a means of necessity. It gave him money to buy food. I spoke to a childhood friend of his that told me a story of after his father had kicked him out of the house, he said Ricky was selling pot behind a local restaurant in Northport so that he would be able to afford to buy a loaf of white bread and a package of cheap bologna to make sandwiches to eat while he was living in the woods. And these woods ended up becoming the crime scene. So the whole thing is incredibly tragic there. But yeah, you know, you sell drugs long enough, eventually you're going to start dipping into your own supply. And across the board, the majority of Ricky's friends and peers that I spoke with said that this kid was taking so many hallucinogenic drugs because he just wanted to numb himself from the reality that he was 16 years old, he had no education, he was no longer going to school, he was unemployable, and his family just wanted nothing to do with him. So the only way that he could really deal with his existence at that point was just to numb it and block it out.
The Acid King. I love doing drugs. I know it'll kill me, but it's my life, and I'm responsible for it. It was around this time that the local teens stopped referring to Richard Casso Jr. as Ricky. His new nickname was the Acid King. If you were a youth in the Northport area looking to experiment with some psychedelics or even a hardened drug user, you knew where to go to get your fix.
If you wanted acid, you went to the Acid King, and that was Ricky. As far as where it directly came from, I think it's one of two places. I know that Ricky was a huge fan of The Who and a big fan of The Doors. And as we know, Jim Morrison nicknamed himself the Lizard King. And also, The Who have a song on their album Tommy called The Acid Queen. So I think maybe one or two of those things lent itself to him having this nickname that was a reflection of his abilities as a drug dealer.
occult influence. The Acid King, Ricky Casso, was a big fan of rock music. Though it was heavily publicized that he was a metalhead, he liked more classic rock than anything else. Ricky played guitar and sang his own songs about the devil. He had become interested in Levian Satanism, though he didn't understand the real meaning behind it. In Season 1, Episode 3, we covered legendary satanic serial killer, the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, and his cousin Mike, who helped send him down his dark path. However, we didn't talk about how another one of his major inspirations was none other than the Acid King, Ricky Casso. Both men had a fascination with Satan, and Casso's iconic photograph was of him wearing an AC/DC t-shirt, the Night Stalker's favorite band. Taking inspiration from the Acid King, Richard Ramirez would also force some of his victims to pledge their allegiance to Satan while they were being murdered. The similarities between Ricky Casso and Richard Ramirez, who would be arrested the following year, did not go unnoticed, and both served as ammo for the religious right in their continuous crusade to save American youth from the devils of heavy metal music and role-playing games.
Ramirez was very much inspired by Casso, and it's something that has never really been pointed out before. You know, Richard Ramirez, one of the big things that led to his arrest was he left an AC/DC hat behind at one of the crime scenes. Casso, who had been arrested 18 months before, caused, you know, a huge uproar with the rock and roll portion of the Satanic Panic because he was arrested with an AC/DC t-shirt on that had a demon on it. So, okay, you know, AC/DC is a popular band, probably a coincidence. Okay, whatever. And then I did some more reading, and it turns out that with one of the victims that lived with Richard Ramirez, she said that Richard Ramirez told her, "Say you love Satan," which is what Ricky Casso said to Gary Lowers when he was stabbing him 18 months prior, and it was national news. It was widely reported that he said that. So you've got, within 18 months, you have two teenage killers named Richard who are wearing AC/DC apparel, and they're killing people, making them say they love Satan. So I think that there's a little bit of a connection there that maybe wasn't explored in Ramirez's lifetime.
Although Ricky spent most of his time alone in the woods, he did have friends. Close friends, in fact. The closest being Jimmy Troiano. Casso and Troiano gave themselves crudely drawn upside-down cross tattoos on their arms, while Ricky called himself the Acid King and spray-painted that name in the park gazebo where him and his friends would gather, do drugs, and listen to music, and try to do their bullshit made-up satanic rituals, Troiano called himself Dracula, or Drac. Very original. Troiano was also a fuck-up. His life start was even harder than Ricky's, as he grew up in an orphanage and never truly had a family home. On November 13th, 1974, 10 years prior to the events that would put the Acid King behind bars, Robert Butch DeFeo murdered his family members in a notorious crime that would make their Amityville house infamous and inspire such movies as the Amityville Horror. The traditional Scandinavian holiday of Walpurgis Night typically involves drinking and bonfires, as well as the burning of different herbs to ward off evil spirits, though there was controversy in the Netherlands tying the festival to satanic rituals. On Walpurgis Night of 1984, Ricky Casso took that approach. And what better way to celebrate than in the Amityville Horror House, drinking and performing their own ritual where the murders of the DeFeo family had happened a decade before?
The whole story behind the Walpurgisnacht ritual that Ricky conducted at the Amityville Horror House all goes back to a separate and slightly unrelated incident that had happened in 1983. Ricky had a friend named Randy Guthler who was talking with another guy at a party, and I don't even think Ricky was at this party, but either way, these two guys were talking, and somehow the subject was brought up that, oh, you know, there is a magic shop in New York City, and I'm not talking about, you know, like David Blaine magic, I'm talking about magic with a K at the end, you know, occult magic. And this shop in Manhattan supposedly was offering $500 to $600 for anyone who could bring them a human skull. So while that subject was brought up, this other person that Randy was talking to mentioned, oh, well, there's a mausoleum near the edge of town that I think would be easy for us to get into. So Randy and his friend broke into this mausoleum and stole the skull and hand of a rather prominent gentleman from Northport's past. He was the president of a number of civic organizations. I think he was the president of the Yacht Club at one point. Rich, well-known guy. He had died in 1930, and they stole these two body parts. Randy's friend had gone off and taken the skull wherever he was going to bring it. And Randy kept the skeletal hand just as a grim souvenir for himself. And he was keeping it in a brown paper lunch sack in his locker at Northport High School. And back then, Northport High School had a really big commons area outside. So on lunch breaks and stuff, people would hang out. This was back when you could smoke cigarettes at high school and stuff like that. And Ricky, even though he had dropped out of school by this point, he would come by and see friends, one of them being Randy. And on one of these occasions, Randy showed him the skeletal hand and said, "Yeah, we took it. My buddy, he's going to make the skull into a mug and sell this at this, shop in New York City for $500-$600. And this kind of got the wheels turning in Ricky's head. Ricky was interested in the occult, specifically Satanism at this point, but he wasn't well read as someone who would frequent a magic shop like that or be 100% devoted to LaVey and Satanism. He was into it on the Ozzy Osbourne level. And so with that in mind, he got this idea, I'm going to go and dig up a skull for myself, but he didn't want to sell it, even though that's been misreported for years and years and years. He wanted to take the skull to the Amityville Horror House and perform a ritual worshiping the devil with a friend of his who's become this real shadowy, legendary figure in the whole Casso mythos, so much so that a lot of people I spoke with, after they read my book, they told me, we didn't even think that this guy was real, because he was featured in another book about Casso that came out in the 80s that was, by and large, mostly fiction. It was called Say You Love Satan. It was one of this huge wave of trashy exploitation true crime paperbacks that came out in the 80s, and it's not even really worth going into. It's so inaccurate. But this guy that Ricky was hanging out with was a 40-year-old Vietnam veteran living in Northport by the name of Pat Toussaint. He was also interested in the occult, so much so that his nickname was Pagan Pat. And Pat had basically talked him into this idea of, we should go to the Amityville Horror House. That's a great place to go and have a ritual. And 112 Ocean Avenue, where the Amityville murders, is only about, a 20-minute to a half-hour drive away from Northport. So it was in the local lexicon. It was this crazy local legend. And eventually, Ricky decided that he was going to go to the Crab Meadow Burying Ground, which is a small cemetery in the middle of the woods, just right on the northern edge of Northport. And it's filled with the town's fathers. A lot of the reporting in the years since have called it an Indian burial ground, but that's not the case at all. It's people from the 1700s, Revolutionary War soldiers, the founders of the town, people like that. And because it's on this hill in the middle of the woods, it's kind of secluded. So he thought this was the perfect place to do it. So he and a group of friends, which included Gary Lowers and Albert Quinones, who later witnessed the murder, they all went there. They did some PCP, smoked some pot. And according to Richard Barton, one of Ricky's friends that was there that night, he said that Ricky dug 7 feet down, never found anything, and just decided to give up. So some time goes by, and a hairdresser working in nearby Huntington goes to drop off some mail in a mailbox after leaving her shift one afternoon. Underneath the mailbox, she sees a bowling ball bag. She goes and opens it up, and there's a head inside of it. So apparently, Randy Guffler's friend, thought that the heat was on him and decided to abandon the skull there. So once the head was found, around the same time, someone had called the police and said, "Hey, someone tried digging up a grave in that old historical graveyard." So they put two and two together and figured, the head must have come from there. Eventually, they got a few more tips that led them to Randy Guffler. And when I interviewed the detective that arrested him for breaking into the mausoleum, he said, "Yeah, we thought that he had done the digging in Crab Meadow." And he starts talking about a mausoleum. So we shut our mouths and just let him keep speaking. So once we got all the information on that, finally we were like, oh, okay, well, we weren't here about that. We were actually here about the one in Crab Meadow, you know, burying ground, and Randy ratted Ricky out. So when Ricky was arrested for that, it became, I don't want to say it was national news, but it made USA Today. It was nowhere near as huge of a story as the murder would become 2 months later, but it became a big deal because when he was arrested, inside of his wallet, he had a photocopied page from a book about Satanism that rattled off a list of the dignitaries in hell. You know, Asmodeus, Baal, stuff like that. The demons and their rankings. And Ricky had photocopied it that day from a book he read at the Northport Library because he thought it was cool. And when he was cuffed and searched, the cops found it. And it became part of the press release. So now all of a sudden there is this huge story in Northport about teenage grave robbers worshiping the devil. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. And then throw in the story about, you know, oh, well, he wanted a skull to go to the Amityville Horror House. And even when the story got mixed up, it was still compelling. Oh, he wanted a skull to, you know, turn it into a beer mug to sell to cultists in New York City. It was like, where does this shit come from? But it was 100% true. And now it was on the front page of the newspaper in Northport. So now any charity that Ricky was getting from friends' parents, you know, oh yeah, your parents kicked you out, you can sleep on our couch, wasn't coming anymore. No one wanted this kid in their house. So he was back to sleeping in the woods. He was doing more and more drugs and losing his grip on reality. And right about this time was the event that kicked off the murders.
Knights of the Black Circle. During the Satanic Panic, rumors of a drug-dealing teenage satanic cult calling themselves the Knights of the Black Circle, similar to the Narco-Satanicos that we covered in Flesh for Satan Part 1, were swirling around the Northport area. Missing animals were believed by locals to have been sacrificed to the Dark Lord by a group of hooded figures that had residents locking their doors. It was said that the Knights of the Black Circle had stolen the tabernacle, the Trinity Episcopal Church, and shit and pissed all over its walls after breaking into the poor box and helping themselves to the congregation's donations. However, this was no Paulo Mayombe cartel of death, or group of figures in dark robes, but something more like a group of teenage posers. According to Reverend Graham Walworth in the New York Times, quote, half of them don't have any idea who the devil is supposed to be. Half the time, they didn't spell the word Satanism right. It was a way for them to feel important. It was something unusual. It was also a form of revolution, a rejection against the standards their parents represent. They picked the theme that was most shocking, the thing that would horrify.
The whole Knights of the Black Circle rumor mill is the biggest load of bullshit in this story. After the murder happened, the newspapers, it was much like the grave robbing thing. They combined a few separate incidents, either deliberately or through laziness or bad reporting, into something that it wasn't. There was a group of teenagers about 4 or 5 years before this all happened, and they weren't even in Northport. They were in the next town over, which was called East Northport. And they were a bunch of hippies. They were part of a group of kids that were originally called Circus. And they were called Circus because they saw themselves as the last of the hippie generation. They were in love with the idea of Woodstock and flower power and all that. And of course, the marijuana that came with that lifestyle. So the people in town, when they would see them walking the streets, they would call them, oh, you look like circus freaks. So they embraced it and they called themselves Circus, the Circus Gang, if you will. When that group kind of splintered off, a few of those members decided to keep selling pot together, but there was a rival group of dealers from a nearby village called Kings Park who would come into East Northport and beat the shit out of them and steal their stash to sell themselves. So they got tired of getting beat up, so they came up with this idea of, okay, let's take our denim jackets, because remember, these were hippies. These were not people walking around in biker jackets or cultist robes or anything like that. It was, you know, a Lee's denim jacket. And they said, okay, let's paint like, you know, a pentacle on the back and some dragons. And how about the Knights of the Black Circle? Which all came about because, you remember those old wooden cable spools you used to see thrown out all the time? They had one in the woods where they used to hang out and drink beer and smoke pot, and it was painted black. And they used it as a table to roll their joints on. So Knights of the Black Circle was a play on words of the Knights of the Round Table. So that's why all of the Knights of the Black Circle had these nicknames like Lord. It was all out of King Arthur. It wasn't out of Satanism, but they deliberately made it seem spooky like that so people would stop beating them up and taking their drugs. And it worked. People were horrified of these kids. And then eventually around 1980, they grew up, they went off to college, they started doing different things, and they were never heard of again. But when the murder happened in 1984 and they started talking to Northport police officers for quotes in their articles, it was stuff like, oh, has Northport ever seen anything like this before? You know, this was a Satanistic murder. Is there a cult in Northport? And they would say things like, oh, no, you know, the closest thing we ever had to a cult was this group of kids called the Knights of the Black Circle. But, you know, they've all moved on. And then the next day, the articles would, you know, the only time Northport has seen anything like this was a gang of kids called the Knights of the Black Circle. And then the day after that, it became Casso was in the Knights of the Black Circle. And then the day after, Casso was the leader of the Knights of the Black Circle. And then after that, the Knights of the Black Circle Satan cult. So it just, it was the world's greatest game of telephone. It was nothing but bullshit. Casso barely knew these guys. I mean, like I said, they were in their mid-20s by the time this happened, and Casso was 17. So it wasn't a Satan cult. Casso wasn't even in it. But, you know, once you open up the front page of the New York Daily News or the New York Post and you see something like teenage leader of the Knights of the Black Circle Satan cult, I mean, that's got legs. That's catchy. So people glommed onto that story. And even though it was disproven years and years and years and years ago, you still Google Knights of the Black Circle and you'll see thousands of results still saying that Casso was the leader and that Gary Lowers was murdered by a dozen chanting cult members in front of a roaring bonfire. But it's just not what happened.
The victim, 17-year-old Gary Lowers, and Ricky had a long history and known each other since grade school. While Ricky was passed out one night, Gary stole 10 bags of PCP from the homeless drug-dealing teen. Though he later repaid his debt to the Acid King, an elephant never forgets, especially one high on cheap LSD.
Eventually, that's what sealed Gary's fate. He was at a party with Ricky in April of 1984. Ricky had 10 bags of PCP in his jacket pocket, and when he passed out, Gary stole the bags. He went to a friend's house, he smoked one of them, decided he didn't like them, and gave a few of them away to the friend. You know, Gary thought it was okay to steal if he was, you know, kind of like Robin Hood about it. But Ricky didn't see it the same way. Ricky woke up the next morning and pretty quickly figured out that Gary was the one that stole his PCP, confronted him about it, and beat him up pretty bad and told him, you know, I want my money back. And Ricky saw this as a huge betrayal. He had known Gary since second grade, and Ricky was on hard times. Like I said, he was living in the woods. He had a pending court case against him for the grave robbing. His family wasn't talking to him. He had no job prospects, no education. So to have a longtime friend steal drugs from you, you know, drugs, your one way of making money, that was a big slap in the face to him. And already with the mental issues and emotional issues he was having, it just festered into this unbridled rage in his mind. And it culminated with, despite the fact that Gary paid him back and friends who were concerned with Ricky beating him up gave him some money, and Ricky even showed up at Gary's house one time and told Gary's mom, like, yeah, your son stole from me, and Gary's mom gave him $50. I mean, he was profiting from this incident by this point. Despite all of this, on the night of June 19th, 1984, Ricky, Jimmy Troiano, who had just been released from jail, a friend of theirs named Albert Quinones, and Gary went into the woods that Ricky had been living in on and off for years. It was a place called Estakia Woods. And they convinced Gary that everything was fine. You know, Ricky said he wasn't mad anymore. And they gave him purple microdot, which it's rarely ever seen these days anymore. But back then it was popular. They were these little tablets that they thought were made out of mescaline, but it was literally just a mixture of low-grade LSD, PCP, and strychnine, rat poison, if you will. So they were taking that, they were smoking PCP, they were smoking pot, they were possibly drinking. So they got all screwed up in the woods that night, And at some point, an argument broke out and Ricky stabbed Gary with a 4-inch folding knife. And during the course of the murder, Jimmy and Albert mentioned this in their statements to the police later, that he had been telling Gary, you know, say you love Satan the whole time he was stabbing him. And at first, Gary would not give in. He kept screaming, no, I love my mother. But eventually, Ricky wore him down, and he eventually, you know, hoping Ricky would stop, said he loved Satan. But he kept hacking away at him. And eventually, after God knows how many stab wounds, the autopsy report says that there was at the very least 36, including several wounds to his face and his eyes. Gary Lowers died, and Ricky and Jimmy and Albert, the two of them who did absolutely nothing to stop the murder, covered up the body with a pile of leaves and branches and just left the woods like it was nothing.
After Gary Lowers died in the Aztecia woods, his corpse was crudely covered with leaves and left to rot in a thickly wooded area full of poison ivy.
Gary just had such a habit of coming and going from his own home that for that whole 2-week period, his parents never reported him missing. They were worried about him. They had asked a couple of his friends, have you seen him? But there was never any formal report filed with the Northport Police Department.
In addition to Gary's parents not reporting their son missing due to his lifestyle, there were plenty of others who also failed to do so. There was a big difference between parents who maybe weren't showing an appropriate level of worry and these people, though, because they knew Gary was dead, and they had seen his body.
In the weeks after the murder, leading up to Casso's arrest, it's honestly stunning what happened. Within, I think, 24 hours, he was already telling people, like, you know, I killed Gary. And people would reply to him with, oh, yeah, you know, whatever, sure. And it's like, no, I'm serious. Do you want to see him? And he, over the course of 2 weeks, led tours. The numbers are up to 2 or 3 dozen, depending on who you talk to. But he brought several of his friends up to Aztecia Woods and showed them Gary's body. And none of them told anyone. None of them told their parents. None of them told the police. Now, of course, there's many reasons for this happening. I'm sure they were horrified that they would end up in a grave next to Gary if they said anything. Or they were afraid that the cops would, you know, say, oh, well, you must have been a part of it. You knew about it. You know, you're going to jail too. So there was this circle of silence. I wouldn't say a conspiracy of silence, but there was a circle of silence surrounding Gary's death.
Casso spread word of the murder fast among Northport teens. Those teens talked to others, and just like the child's game telephone, as the story was passed from adolescent to adolescent, it evolved over time. Rather than the sudden rage-stabbing death that he experienced, it was said that Lowers was burned and tortured for hours, and slowly dismembered alive.
Once they got to the woods, they decided to make a small fire to sit and, you know, quote-unquote, trip out to. And it had been raining in Northport that week, so the wood was soggy, it really wasn't catching fire, and according to Triano, Ricky was getting mad that this wasn't happening. Gary offered up one of his socks to start the fire, and when that didn't work, he offered up another sock, and then eventually Ricky said, well, why don't you throw your jacket in? Maybe that'll work. And Gary said, I don't really want to do that, but, you know, how about I just throw my sleeves in and then I could turn my denim jacket into like a cool, you know, metalhead vest. And they were like, yeah, that'll work. Now, after the murder, reports were generated in the press that Gary had been tortured, that it was a 4-hour-long torture session. But, I mean, I can't believe that those rumors got as far as they did. It's just physically impossible. Gary Lowers was stabbed over a dozen times in the back. I mean, you're not going to live for 4 hours with that many knife wounds in your back, let alone the ones that he received to his eyes. So the whole murder itself probably was done and over with in a matter of minutes, if not seconds. I mean, some of those wounds could have possibly caused instant paralysis if they hadn't severed any of his spinal column at all. When he was found, he was skeletal, so they were never able to, you know, 100% determine this. But the wounds were so severe, there was no way that this was going to be a 4-hour torture session, as the New York Post said. But at one point during the stabbing, This is kind of murky because Ricky doesn't touch on it in his confession, but Triano did. And pieces of Gary's hair were found at the crime scene later, weeks later when the body was recovered. When Triano was asked about this, he said, oh, well, we just cut off a bit of his hair while Ricky was stabbing him to humiliate him, and we were throwing it in the fire. So I guess you could say there was torture in that respect, that they were going above and beyond just the simple act of murder. They were actively humiliating him. But this idea that they kept him alive for 4 hours, you know, burning him or anything like that, or cutting parts off of his body, it's just not true.
In addition to the rumors of ritualistic torture, another story has evolved over time. Once the murder was complete, Ricky claimed that Satan appeared to him in the form of a black crow, cawing 3 times in a signal of approval of the vile act that Castle had just committed in his name.
After they had covered Gary Lowers' body with the pile of fallen leaves and twigs and sticks and all that, Casso claimed that he had heard a crow cry out 3 times. And he told the police that he took this as a sign from the devil that he was pleased with what he had done. In the years since, the story's been kind of twisted a little bit. In, you know, some versions of the story say that, oh, the devil came to Ricky in the form of a crow and told him to kill Gary Lowers. But as far as what Ricky told the police himself, this was all after the fact. It was after he was done stabbing him that he heard the crow cry and interpreted it as, oh, well, the devil's pleased. The devil did not come to him as a crow and say, I need you to kill Gary. It wasn't anything like that. But again, a story like that is going to have legs. I don't know. It's something out of a horror movie, and people latched onto it.
Though he never outright admitted feeling guilty or regret for the murder of Gary Lowers, Ricky's short time left on this planet was a tumultuous one, plagued by nightmares and the need to constantly look over his shoulder, and the fear of pursuit by the police and by specters and beings from beyond the grave.
I think Ricky was haunted by what he had done. I don't know if he was remorseful. I mean, he was clearly proud of what he did. He led tours to the body. He kicked the kid's head into the grave. You know, there's no two ways around that. But a few people told me that he had been having nightmares the whole time leading up to his arrest. They didn't know why. At the time, a friend of his was letting him sleep on his floor, and he told me a story how Ricky would get up in the middle of the night freaking out, and he said, they're coming back to get me. And when he asked who, and he said, dead people. So obviously there was a portion of this that bothered him, but I 100% do not believe that he hanged himself because he felt bad about what he did. For years, he had been telling people, if I'm ever thrown in jail, I'm going to hang myself. He had attempted to commit suicide a year prior when his parents committed him to the South Oaks Mental Hospital, which decades prior was known as the Amityville Asylum. He had tried to hang himself with a sweater in the showers while he was there undergoing drug rehab. So he definitely had suicidal impulses. He had told people for years if he was ever locked up, he would hang himself, and he knew he was facing serious time. So as far as this being an act of remorse, I definitely wouldn't bet on it.
Mom, I was out of my mind on mescaline. I didn't know what I was doing. The guy ripped me off. Ricky Casso on the phone with his mother after the murder. Soon Ricky could feel the heat and the pressure word spreading about what he had done. Everyone knew about the Acid King. He had crafted his persona, although be it out of necessity. And prior to the murder, he was already a local legend for his involvement with the stolen bones. In the short time since Ricky had killed Gary Lowers, he had personally led tours to his victim's corpse, ran his mouth all over town, and he knew that while he remained in the Northport area, he was living on borrowed time.
They honestly might have gotten away with it. At one point on June 30th, 1984, word had gotten back to Ricky and Jimmy that the land that Astakia Woods sat on had been sold and that it was going to become a series of neighborhoods in Northport, which are there now. This did happen. They got panicked and pretty much decided, okay, we need to figure out what we're going to do here. At one point, they debated burning down the woods, but then they decided against it. They were worried that a construction crew putting a house there was eventually going to stumble upon the body, which was just laying there rotting under a pile of leaves for 2 weeks, in the middle of a very hot and humid summer, by the way. So Gary had pretty much decomposed to the point of near skeletonization at this point. So they grabbed some shovels and went back and decided to bury him. They buried him in a very shallow grave. And at one point, in one of the eeriest pieces of testimony I've ever listened to, Northport Police Chief Bob Howard talks about in several interviews how Triano and Casso said, oh yeah, when we picked up Gary's body to move him into the grave, his head fell off, so we kicked it in. These are the kids you're dealing with here. It's the callousness displayed is stunning. It's horrible. And so they packed some dirt on top of him, and they hitchhiked up to upstate New York, where Casso used to vacation during the summer with his family. His father had been gifted a small cabin up there by Ricky's grandparents, and so the family would go there during the summers of his childhood. And he had some friends up there, so they hitchhiked up there, and they asked a friend, you know, can you help us find a car? We want to go to California. I think they were starting to realize, you know, we're not going to get away with this for very long. So they bought an old Pontiac for $50, and they were going to just split town and live in California. I don't know, as beach bums maybe, who knows? But what happened in this incredibly stupid twist of fate, they decided, well, you know, it might be really hard to finance this trip out to California trying to sell our drug stash to strangers along the way, and it could be pretty risky. We could get busted doing that. Why don't we just drive back to Northport for one night and sell the whole thing to all of our friends, and then we'll just hit the road again in the morning. So they did that. What they didn't realize was they had already sealed their fate a couple days earlier. Before they had left for upstate New York, Jimmy had run into an old friend of his, and she had asked, well, where's Gary? And he said, oh, he's rotting up in Estacia Woods. Ricky killed him. And just like everyone else, she said, oh, yeah, whatever, you're full of it. And he said, no, do you want to go see? She did not go up there, but she was so spooked by what he had said that she called the police. And 3 days later, after searching the woods, they recovered the remains. So literally, as Ricky and Jimmy were driving back into Northport after picking up this car upstate, the police were removing the remains of Gary Lowers from Estacia Woods. Ricky and Jimmy partied downtown. It was the 4th of July. They were unbelievably stoned on PCP and were selling as much of their stash as they could. And finally, around 5 a.m., when they decided to get some sleep before hitting the road again, they parked their car across the street from the Northport Yacht Club in front of someone's house. That person got up for work and noticed, hey, there's a car I don't recognize outside and there's kids sleeping in it. She called the police. The police showed up and realized, oh, there's our two suspects. And Ricky and Jimmy were arrested. Albert Quinones was brought in later that day and offered immunity for his testimony. And Ricky almost immediately confessed to the murder, saying that Gary had been ripping off everyone in town and that he deserved what he got. He told them everything about the satanic elements of the murder, including, you know, I heard a crow caw three times and I interpreted this as Satan's approval. And he was booked, fingerprinted, mugshotted. He was, you know, wearing the famous AC/DC shirt, which the press also photographed him in. And it immediately launched this firestorm of press interest.
Satanic murder in sleepy little Long Island town. Youth arrested in AC/DC t-shirt. Claims he made his victim say he loved Satan and the devil came to him in the form of a crow.
A Hollywood writer could not come up with this shit. It was the story of the year, possibly the story of the decade, up until the Berlin Wall came down. So everyone was frothing at the mouth for a piece of this story, and before Ricky could comment on it himself, he hanged himself in his jail cell the night after his arrest.
Though Ricky had taken the easy way out and avoided prosecution altogether, his friends and accomplices weren't so lucky. During his interrogation, Jimmy Triano admitted that he helped hold Lowers down while Ricky stabbed him, but later he changed his story. In exchange for immunity from prosecution for his part of the night's events, Albert Quinones testified against Triano. In addition to Quinones' testimony, the prosecution's character witness, 16-year-old Lori Walsh, also took the stand. Walsh claimed Troiano had sold her acid in the past, and she was the voice who eventually guided the police in the direction of the Acid King and his cohorts. Both the prosecutor and the lawyer for the defense of James Troiano agreed that this was not about Satan, it was about drugs. Contrary to the beliefs of many who were influenced by the satanic panic, both sides of the court could concur that this was yet another story of a drugged-out high school dropout and misguided youth falling by the wayside. Though Ricky came from what the community considered a good and decent family, he was still able to slip through the cracks and descend into drug-induced madness. I think suicide would be the ultimate high. Then, I would finally be at peace. Ricky Casso. Various sources online reported that Ricky's father, Dick Casso, also committed suicide in 1991. However, these rumors are unsubstantiated.
In the years after Ricky's suicide and the case faded out from national interest, there was a rumor that started going around that when Ricky's father, Dick Casso, died in 1991, he had also died as a result of suicide. But when I interviewed Ricky's sister, she told me that it was actually a long descent into what eventually killed him. He'd suffered from Lyme disease and eventually brought on dementia. And by the time he died in an assisted living facility in 91, he didn't really know his family's names anymore. His mind was just mush. And to some of Ricky's friends, they saw this as justice, because a lot of people really blamed Dick Casso for his son turning out to be a murderer. When I interviewed, it was actually the same friend who told me the story about Dick beating his son with a broom handle because he was late to football practice. You know, he told me, he goes, "I'll never forgive Dick Casso for what he did to my friend." And I said, well, you know, he died in 1991 of dementia as a result of Lyme disease. And he told me, "Thank you for telling me that." So there was no love lost in the community as far as people who knew Ricky and had seen firsthand what Dick Casso had done. He was a very, very abusive parent by all accounts.
Whether it be from his traumatic childhood, his extensive drug use, or the influence of satanic forces, Ricky Casso will always be remembered for his vile actions in the Aztequia Woods on June 19th, 1981. And one line in particular would continue to fuel the fears of American citizens. Say you love Satan.
Won't you meet me down in the forest? Don't take that sacrifice for granted. And if you have mislaid what I asked you to say, I might have to cut you. Take you down to the river. Pledge your allegiance there forever. And if you were unfaithful, I've got the weapons. I will have to sacrifice. Say you love Satan, Ricky says. Say you love Ricky, Satan says. And that's just the plastic bag I put over your head. Say you love Satan, Ricky says. Meet me down in the courtroom. Play me your Judas Priest tape. How could this be for a bag of speed? You commit murder in Satan's name. You might have been a victim, but I'm not sorry for what I must do. Put you to rest with a knife in your chest. I just had to kill you. They love saving Ricky Sands. Say you love Ricky Sands. Then that's just a plastic bag I put over your head. Say you love Satan, Ricky says.
Everybody, come on.
Say you love Satan, Ricky says. Say you love Ricky Satan says. And that's just a plastic bag I put over your head. Say you love Satan, Ricky says.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of True Crime Horror Story. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode. Suggested movies similar to today's cases: For Say You Love Satan, The Acid King, the upcoming documentary from author Jesse Pollack, and suggested reading, also The Acid King from Jesse Pollack as well. If you like what you hear here on True Crime Horror Story, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You can also think about joining our Patreon, www.patreon.com/truecrimehs, and then stay tuned after the show on Patreon for the True Crime Horror Story After Show with Dom and JD, as well as early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content available only on Patreon. This episode features music by Mechanical Ghost, The Quiet Type, the world-famous Crawl Space Brothers, and Ethan Urban, and artwork by Nuclear Heat Graphics. Sources for this episode's cases are available in the credits section of our website. Has violent crime impacted you or someone close to you? Send us your story at truecrimehorrorstory@gmail.com. True Crime Horror Story. Sometimes truth is more brutal than fiction.
Planet Earth, about to be recycled.
We are all evil in some form or another, are we not? Evil has always existed. Perfect world most people seek shall never come to pass, and it's going to get worse.
Well, thanks so much, Jesse, for all your expertise on Ricky Casso, and I just have some questions for you as for your career as a writer and a filmmaker.
Sure.
So first off, what is your first memory of true crime growing up? Were you a Forensic Files kid? Was it a book? What first inspired you to get into the genre?
Oh, man, that is such a great question, because I've always wanted to talk about that, but no one ever asks me when I do these podcasts. And I have a lot of fun doing these podcasts, so that's not a slight or anything towards the other hosts that have interviewed me. It's just always, when I'm on these shows, it's always very focused as to, like, the version of that question I would be asked is, where did you first hear of, like, Ricky Casso? But, No, I have a very clear memory of when I first became interested in true crime. My grandfather, Butch, he had a book in his I don't want to call it like a library, but it was like on the shelf in the living room, and it was called Great Mysteries of North America. And at the time, I was really into Bigfoot and stuff like that. And on the cover, it has this great spooky shot of like a misty forest. And I was like, ooh, this looks like it might have Bigfoot stuff in it. And it did. It had not Loch Ness Monster, but, you know, other cryptids and stuff like that. And so I just kept flipping through it. And then I came upon the chapter about the Zodiac Killer in it. And I had never heard of the Zodiac Killer before. And it showed, you know, pictures of the cipher and the witness sketch from the Paul Stein murder. And it honestly scared the shit out of me. Just looking at the cipher alone, it was like, oh my God, the person that wrote this not only is a murderer, he's a madman. You know, there's this crazy code that he came up with and no one knows what's in it. You know, what secrets are there? He's talking about killing people so they'll become his slaves in the afterlife. I mean, you know, like I said with the Casso stuff before, the greatest Hollywood writer couldn't come up with something this disturbing. And it's honestly why I sincerely believe that he was one of the first terrorists. Like, this wasn't just about murder for him. This was about, you know, I am going to keep the world in my grasp with this crazy shit that I'm telling the newspapers and the police to scare the hell out of them. You know, bus bombs and like I said, the slaves in the afterlife. It was just this incredible story. And I'm sure a lot of people listening have a moment like this too, where they realized like that sensation of fear and intrigue. Like it was a rush of adrenaline. And even though I was horrified by the things I was reading, it was like, I got to know more. I want to know more. So I bought the Graysmith book and, you know, checked out everything I could find on him from the library. And it grew into an interest about other serial killers. And then I'm sure, again, like a lot of other listeners tuning in right now, I got into Cold Case Files and Forensic Files and American Justice with Bill Curtis. all that stuff. I was a true crime junkie in college, and it probably didn't do a whole lot for, you know, my mental well-being, you know, watching these blocks of Forensic Files every night going to sleep, but I lived and breathed it. And I eventually, you know, I never had any intention of becoming a true crime writer, which is the weird thing thinking back. It was just something that I read and enjoyed because it fascinated me. I wasn't like a Manson groupie or, you know, a Columbine aficionado or anything like that. It was just, I enjoyed reading about it for the same reason I guess people enjoy reading Stephen King books. It's like, it's scary, it's interesting, and it provides a jolt of adrenaline. But I never sat there and thought, man, I would love to do this. You know, I need to be like Robert Graysmith and find a pet case to write about. And it wasn't until about, I want to say it was late 2011, early 2012, that I was flipping through the back issues of a magazine that I had occasionally wrote contributing articles for as a teenager. It's this magazine called Weird New Jersey, which is published twice a year. You guessed it, in New Jersey, where I come from. And I had mostly wrote in about, you know, ghost stories, you know, local legends from where I grew up, you know, personalized property, that kind of stuff. I was never on the true crime beat, which is now my beat at the magazine, ironically. But I was flipping through a back issue trying to find an article that I had written a few years prior. And while trying to find this old article, I stumbled upon a 6-page spread that the magazine's co-editor Mark Moran had written back in 2004, I want to say, maybe 2006. But either way, it was about, you know, 5-6 years beforehand. And it was about this murder case that had happened 2 towns over from where I grew up. I grew up in Clark and Rahway inside of Union County, New Jersey. And about 10 miles away from where I grew up, this place called Springfield in the 1970s, there was a girl that went missing while hitchhiking. 6 weeks later, her body was found in a rock quarry. And it was on top of a 40-foot cliff. And supposedly, there were all these occult objects that were found around her. Supposedly, there was a frame around the body in the shape of a coffin made out of logs, and that someone had took twigs and arranged them in the shape of crucifixes around her. All this crazy stuff. And I'm reading about it, and I felt that same, that weird cocktail of fear and intrigue and adrenaline that I had felt when I first read about the Zodiac Killer. And I was like, oh my God, this is such an incredible, horrifying, and tragic story. And it happened right where, you know, I grew up, years before I was born. I wasn't born until 1988. But still, it was like, how did I never hear about this growing up? We had always heard about John List when I was growing up. I don't know if you've covered him yet, but he was the guy in Westfield, New Jersey in 1971 who shot his entire family to death, hid the bodies in this mansion that he had, and fled for 18 years and wasn't caught until America's Most Wanted did an age progression sculpture bust of him. And a neighbor ratted him out and said, hey, I know who that is. That's Bob Clark down the hall. And it turned out.
Yeah, and he was like in Colorado or something at the time, right? I remember that. Yeah. I heard that one.
Yeah. Oh, that's a incredible case. You should definitely cover it sometime. But that was the local boogeyman we always heard growing up because he was the next town over. And so I was like, how have I never heard about this? You know, this article came out 6 years ago. I bet there's probably a really great book about this story. And I looked for it because I wanted to read it. And there wasn't. So I was like, well, maybe Cold Case Files did an episode on it. And there wasn't. There was nothing about this girl. And we're New Jersey. We're the only ones that had reported on it. So much so that when Mark Moran and the other co-editor and founder of the magazine, Mark Skirman, first got the tip about it, they couldn't find, this is long before newspapers.com and all that stuff, they couldn't find anything online about her, so they thought it was an urban legend. It wasn't until someone dug into some microfiche articles and found the original coverage that they realized this was a true story. So I basically resorted to, okay, I want to read a book about this case. No one's written it. I guess I'm going to have to write it myself. So I teamed up with Mark Moran, and we dug into the original newspaper coverage. We got names from the articles, Jeanette's family and friends, and this girl, Jeanette DePalma, who had gone missing and was found murdered. So when they had first gotten this tip in the late 90s about this supposed ritual sacrifice murder that happened in Springfield, they figured it was an urban legend and all this stuff. You know, Google wasn't even around yet, so they were probably using InfoSeek, and there was no newspapers.com, so there was not this instant access to finding archival material. But when they printed the letter, the tip that they got a reply from a reader saying, oh yeah, her name was Jeanette DePalma, and she was found on an altar. So they were able to put together that 6-page spread that I read years and years later. So when Mark and I teamed up to write this book, we utilized these original newspaper articles to get the names of the original detectives and Jeanette's family and friends. And we basically started from square one and re-interviewed all these people to try and get a good idea of what happened to this girl. I mean, this incredible, horrifying, tragic mystery with elements of the occult. I mean, when we first did our first round of press for it, one of the people that were that was interviewing us for the radio said, this sounds like a season of True Detective, you know, with elements of Twin Peaks in there. It's hard to believe it's real, but it 100% happened. And it culminated in my first book, Death on the Devil's Teeth, which came out in 2015.
Death on the Devil's Teeth, The Strange Murder That Shocks Suburban New Jersey. And where can they find that if listeners want to purchase that book?
You can get it on Amazon. You can also get it from weirdnewjersey.com. I think they have a bundle package with it with another true crime special issue that we later did. But yeah, wherever books are sold, you can get it.
All right. We'll definitely be looking forward to checking that one out. And then let's get into the Acid King documentary. You know, you wrote your book on the Acid King, Ricky Casso, which thank you for all the information you provided me with this episode. But this documentary coming out, I'm really looking forward to it.
What had happened with the documentary was, even before the book was finished being written, you know, when a deal is made for a book, there are trade magazines like Publishers Marketplace, Publishers Weekly, and stuff like that where they're announced. And a couple TV people had saw, oh, there's a new Ricky Casso book coming out. And so I was approached by a few TV producers and stuff like that who said they really wanted to turn it into a documentary or a docuseries or a movie. And the more and more I talked with them, and there were several of them, they all really wanted to hype on the parts of the story that weren't true. And I would explain to them, I'm like, okay, the Knights of the Black Circle were not a Satan cult, and even if they were, Ricky wasn't in it, and he wasn't the leader. And they would say, oh, well, you know, do you think we could kind of, like, imply that he was? You know, we have executives, and they want ratings, and this stuff gets ratings. And it was just shitty deal offer after shitty deal offer, and people like 100% asking me, you know, like, can you bend the facts on TV for ratings when we interview you? And I just didn't want to be a part of that. And in the terms of my contract, I retained the movie rights for this story. And I thought, you know, the only way that this story is going to get onto the screen with any integrity and the facts, you know, being kept intact is if I'm at the helm of it. So along with my creative partner, Dan Jones, who's my co-host on two of my podcasts that I do, Podcast 1289, which is a humorous podcast. It's kind of like in the same vein as like Last Podcast on the Left. We find the weirdest, paranormal, true crime, UFO stories out there. And in a roundtable format, he and I, along with our friends, we sit and we mock these stories. It's pretty funny. It's also very not safe for work. A lot of us are from New Jersey. We have potty mouths, people. But check it out. Podcast 1289. We're on iTunes and all those platforms. And the other new show that Dan and I launched is called True Crime Movie Club. And what we do is we watch all those horrible, like, direct-to-video true crime films, and we review them and shit all over them. And that's pretty funny, too. And you can find True Crime Movie Club in the same places as 1289, iTunes, Stitcher, all that good stuff. So Dan, who has a background in photography and is a huge movie buff like me, I called him up and I said, Dan, we should get a small crew together and go to Northport and film interviews and put a documentary together. And we were really in the unique position to do that because in addition to the filmed interviews that we did, I also had hundreds of photos and case documents relating to the murder that were not utilized in the book. For whatever reason, the editors at Simon & Schuster, who put out the Acid King book with me, they decided not to put photos in the book. So I was like, okay, well, this is a vehicle to get this visual information out there, because a lot of these photos had never been seen before. And I'm not just talking about like gruesome crime scene photos, which we didn't include in the movie, much to the chagrin of some nasty Amazon reviewers we had for a little bit there. But, childhood photos of Ricky, photos of Jimmy and Gary, photos of downtown Northport in the 80s before a lot of things were changed. Interesting stuff. So he said, yeah, I'm game. And we hired a couple camera crews, Rusty Tagliarini from Antiquity Echoes. He came with us on the first leg of shooting. The second leg of shooting, Dan and I shot ourselves. And then for the third leg, which was the California second unit where a lot of interviews were shot, our friend Summer Jones, the director of Yes, No, Goodbye, the Ouija documentary, she shot those interviews for us. And for a year, we edited this all together and we just figured, okay, well, we'll put it up on Amazon and, you know, whoever wants to watch it, they can watch it there. And we put the first director's cut of it up on there, and it was polarizing. A lot of people loved it. A lot of people didn't like it because, I guess, like I said, they were expecting, you know, gruesome crime scene photos and all that shit. And eventually, after about a month of it being up, we got an offer from ITN Films for distribution. So we took it down from Amazon because we were getting a new HD master of the film cut and ready to go. We're going to tweak some things. You know, some of the criticisms we got in our reviews of the first cut were valid. So we're going to fix some issues. We're going to make this the best cut of the film that we possibly can. And ITN is going to be putting it out on a special edition DVD. There's going to be commentary, special features, deleted scenes, and it'll be available on streaming on multiple platforms, and that should be later this year.
Really looking forward to it.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for coming on the show and all your expertise about Ricky Casso. Is there anything else you'd like to promote or talk about?
I really can't think of anything other than definitely check out the podcast that I mentioned earlier. If you're into, like me, if you're into true crime, but you also love stuff like Bigfoot and aliens and stuff like that, and you like a humorous take on it, check out Podcast 1289. And if you're like me and you're sick and tired of seeing, oh, cool, a true crime movie, let me put that on. And then you realize it's, you know, cheap, direct-to-video, low-budget trash. Go check out True Crime Movie Club and listen to us do in-depth reviews on these films and shit all over them. We just put out an episode about The Haunting of Sharon Tate, which was a fucking awful film. It was terrible. So definitely check those out. And if you're interested in reading more about Ricky Casso, The Acid King is available wherever books are sold. It's on Amazon. If you don't want to support Amazon, and I totally don't blame you if you don't, you can get it through IndieBound. BarnesandNoble.com has it. I think there's probably even copies of it on eBay, probably. But yeah, you can pick that up. My first book is called Death on the Devil's Teeth, The Strange Mystery, The Strange Murder That Shocked Suburban New Jersey. And that is also available wherever books are sold. And my next book project after these, I'm covering the Sid and Nancy case. And the name of that book as of right now is Room 100. So keep an eye out for that in the coming year or two.
Well, thank you so much, Jesse, for coming on the show. Listeners, you can follow Jesse on social media at jpolakauthor on Instagram. Is that the same on Twitter as well?
Yep. Yeah, if you want to go on the cesspool that is Twitter.
I try to stay off myself. Twitter's one I haven't really figured out yet. I'm kind of Instagram heavy, so.
Dude, it sucks. Instagram rules. Everyone I meet on Instagram's nice. Like when they say my book is cool and all that stuff, and like, you know, like, hey, I saw your documentary, it was awesome. But like whenever I check on Twitter, it's always just like, man, shut the fuck up, libtard. And I'm like, oh man, I hate this site.
Yeah, me as well. But thanks for coming on the show. It's been a pleasure to have you. And like I said, when I get my Sid and Nancy case done, that's going to be season 3. We're on season 2 right now.
Awesome.
So when that rolls around, maybe we can do it all again and promote your next one.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. And Podcast 1289 did a Sid and Nancy episode too. We did it for our Valentine's Day special last year. So check that out. It's like I said, it's a more humorous take on it, but we did a real deep dive, and it became such a deep dive that when my agent said, well, what do you want to do for your next book? I said, I'm kind of obsessed with the Sid and Nancy case right now. I know it's kind of done to death, but do you think I've got a shot of doing it? And we signed with Backbeat Books, and I can't really go into it, but we've discovered a lot of new information that's going to be going into this book as well. Gonna, just like with the Casso case, gonna shatter a lot of myths while you know, shedding light on some facts that have been buried for almost half a century now, which is crazy saying that shit about punk rock, man. Like, what the fuck? The 70s were only, you know, 25, 30 years ago when I was a kid. Now it's almost 50. Getting old.
Dude, with the Reagan Youth story, there's so much that with my interview with Paul Kribble and my research that I found that there's none of this out there. Even with Joel Rifkin, like I found more about like Joel Rifkin than some of the stuff online. You know, people have covered him as a serial killer in my interviews with Paul and what happened. There's so many inaccuracies out there, you know, and yeah, like you said, just doing a deep dive on it sometimes can shed some new light on even on an old case.
Yeah, it's amazing what you can find out when you stop relying on only Wikipedia to write podcast episodes, people. Wink.
Yeah.
Just throwing a little shade out there for people that don't do it as well as you and others do. But hey, thank you so much for having me on. I had a really great time, and like you said, and I said, let's do some stuff together. This was cool.
All right, thanks a lot, Jesse. Thanks for coming on the show, and good luck with your next book. And I look forward to seeing the Acid King documentary.
Thank you, man. I look forward to hearing the Reagan Youth and Rifkin episodes. That sounds like some crazy shit.
Won't you lead me down in the forest? Don't take that sacrifice for granted. But if you have mislaid what I asked you to save, I might have to cut you, take you down to the river, pledge your allegiance there forever. And if you were unfaithful, I've got a weapon. I will have to sacrifice you. Sailor Satan, break your sails. Sailor, break your Satan sails. And that's just a plastic bag I put over your head. Sailor Satan, break yourselves. Meet me down in the courtroom. Blame me, erase. commit murder in Satan's name. You might have been a victim, but I'm not sorry for what I must do. Lay you to rest with a knife in your chest. I just had to kill you. Say you love sacred kisses. Say you love Ricky Satan cells. And that's just a plastic bag I put over your head. Say you love sacred kisses. Say you love sacred kisses. Say you love Satan, Ricky Sells.